NetCredit is here to say yes to a personal loan or line of credit when other lenders say no. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partner. NetCredit, credit to the people.
Ask Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off Duration and SuperDeck products May 17th through the 20th. That means 30% off our most popular color family, blue. Psychologists have found it to be soothing and relaxing, which makes it especially great for bedrooms and bathrooms. And of course, get 30% off all of our other colors. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
So what happened to Ian when he went to jail? He was a 21-year-old kid, basically, going to jail. What happened to him in jail? And then the amazing ways in which he transformed his life afterwards. So here's Ian again.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
What did the judge sentence you to?
So he ends up sentencing me to 3 years in prison, 1 year home confinement, and 3 years of supervised release, which is like probation in the feds.
And did you think, how long did you actually think you would serve?
I didn't know. I mean, you hear mixed things, especially as a kid and stuff. I thought maybe 50%. I didn't know, but then there was programming. See, like the thing about prison and everything, you ask one guy the same question, you ask 10 different guys like the same question, you're going to get 10 different answers. No one really knows. Every person's scenario is different. Even the idea of COVID changed everything. Now so many people can get house arrest, this and that. But in my scenario, I ended up doing 26 months inside, 3 months of halfway house slash home confinement, and then a year on an ankle monitor on home confinement under probation.
And were you in like in a low security place or?
They put me through diesel therapy. I was everywhere. I went from the Wyatt Detention Center in Rhode Island. I went to Brooklyn. I went to Fort Dix, a low security prison. From there, I went to the Danbury, Connecticut low security prison, which is where I was from. I was in Philly Detention Center for a little bit. I was in Brooklyn again during transportation. They sent me all the way out to Chicago for a little bit. I was in Chicago. I was in Oklahoma City. I went on.
Why'd they send you so many places?
So the first time I got caught up in like a cell phone investigation, which I was found not guilty of, and then they just moved prisons. But the second time when I got to Danbury, which was my hometown, which was going to be great, you know, I was right next to my parents, and one of the guards ends up reporting that I used to date his cousin. So it was a conflict of interest. So they locked me in the shoe, solitary, the hole. I was there for almost 6 months. And then I had my parents calling every day. They get a state senator to call. They get a lawyer to call. And that pissed the BOP off, the Bureau of Prisons. So they send me on Conair, the airplane ran by the U.S. Marshals. That's when they transported me through the system where you go. It took me 2 weeks to get to Wisconsin from Connecticut. You go to Oklahoma City. You go to Chicago. And then eventually I landed in Wisconsin, which the camp was great. Oxford, Wisconsin prison camp. This thing was cushy. You know who I was there with? George Papadopoulos from Donald Trump's initial team. He was there for 2 weeks. But there's cell phones getting in. People are running through the woods to like hook up with their wives. People are smuggling in, you know, McDonald's, sushi, pizza. I remember eating Chicago deep dish pizza one weekend. We're watching movies. It's crazy. There's a track. This is what they mean by club fed. But I mean, it was crazy. And then I got out in January 2019.
And what was the most violent prison you were in? Like, were you ever, was there a point where you were scared?
I would say Fort Dix would have been the most violent. Guys were definitely like trying me, I guess you could call it, because I looked like a sex offender in their eyes. Because in these federal prisons, there's not that many young white kids in there really at all for fraud. That's more like the average like fraud guys in his 30s or 40s. In these prisons, and I'm 21 years old, which is hard to believe. It's 7 years ago now, but yeah.
And when they say, when you say they were trying you, what does that mean?
So they would, like, you know, try to extort me, try to get me to buy them commissary, buy them a cell phone, things like that. So it's really about just like navigating and learning how to survive and get through the system.
How do you survive that?
So I just played, I guess, played it smart. I found this clip actually went viral when I told it on TikTok. I started befriending some of these big guys in there, and they didn't really have much money. So I started buying them commissary every week and playing cards with them and hanging around them. And because of that, other guys weren't going to bother me because they didn't want to, like, say, interfere with those guys' hustle. Because the other inmates are looking at it as those guys are hustling me. But really, I'm just paying them commissary as a friend, as whatever, an acquaintance. And that's how it was structured. And everyone left me alone at that point. And then there's the process of, like, showing paperwork to show that you're not a sex offender, you're not a rat or anything like that. And then guys left me alone. And they gave me the nickname McLovin in prison.
Yeah, you do look a little like McLovin.
Yeah, McLovin, Squints, and Bieber. They called me Bieber for, like, Justin Bieber.
And so were you in prison not with, like, violent offenders, but with other fraud offenders?
No, you're with in the lows, you're with violent people. You're guys that have committed murder, sex offenders, some of the worst sex offenders, anything, robberies. At the camp, there's no violent people.
So, I mean, did you know what everybody was convicted of? Like, if someone was a murderer or a sex offender or whatever?
You could find out if you wanted to through the grapevine, or you look it up on a cell phone. If someone had a contraband phone or anything like that, you could find things out.
Was it better to just not talk to anybody?
Yeah, I mean, if I had a recommendation for someone to go to prison, but I was in everyone's business moving around too much. I was a kid, you know, I was just screwing around. I was gambling. I was doing whatever. I was trying to hustle, make money. I was getting myself into trouble, which I didn't need to be doing, but that's just, like, the type of person I am, you know? It's like, you know, that expression where they say, like, or like the people that go and smell the shit or whatever to see what it smells like. That was me.
And why would you do that, knowing that I could get you into maybe stay in jail longer?
I think I was just curious and I missed the adrenaline. Like, I went from having so much freedom, running this club, always getting into trouble and sticking up to authority to prison. So you kind of have to, I was getting, like, that fix, you know, that high, that adrenaline.
And what were, I mean, you on your YouTube channel, you interview various other inmates and stuff. What were some of the most, like, what are the stories that intrigued you that you found in prison?
Like the stories that I hear about now?
Yeah.
I think what intrigues me the most is, like, the times where guys kind of, like, get bullied. Like, I had a guy on and he was literally talking about how he got raped in the prison shower, and just, like, hearing how, like, the system fails in that aspect, and why they're taking people that are nonviolent and putting them with violent people, and the politics about that and the gangs and things like that. Like, I'm interested in the psychological aspect of it and what people are thinking and how they're navigating and how they're moving around, and just, like, where the system fails on that level.
And did you see that, any of that, in the prisons you were in?
No, I didn't physically see it, but I'd hear stories. Like, I heard stories about, you know, it was always really the sex offenders that would get beat up, or someone that, like, didn't pay a debt. But there were stories about, like, a sex offender got a mop handle, like, shoved up his ass in the hallway, and things like that you would hear about. And then you would see fights, you know, the occasional fight, but, like, not some of, to the extent of the stories that I hear on my podcast, because I was only at that low security prison for, like, 6 or 7 months. But yeah, crazy things happen.
And in the solitary confinement, what does that actually mean? Does that mean you can't go outside and you're in a room with no windows and they give you food once a day? Or what does the solitary confinement mean?
So you're locked down, you know, 23 hours a day, 24 hours technically on the weekends. But during the week, you get an hour of rec time, which they handcuff you and bring you to a cage outside, a little cage. So you're moving from one cell to another cell, which is in a cage by yourself. You get a shower 3 times a week, no commissary. You're getting 3 meals a day, no seconds or anything. So you get very skinny when you're in the shoe. They're not big portions. You can get a book. I was reading like a book a day at one point because that's all you could do all day. You wake up, unless you're doing push-ups or whatever, you're reading all day and you're just stuck there laying on your bed. You're talking to other inmates for the cell next door at the Danbury prison because I wasn't there like in solitary, the SHU, because I was in trouble. They let me become the orderly. So I was painting cells. It looked like Alcatraz with the old bars. And they had me paint the cells white, so that got me out of the cell. But the shoe's terrible. It sucks. It's mentally draining. It's just not a good place to be in.
And then, so then you get out and you go to a halfway house or whatever. Like, what was your?
I go to a halfway house in Waterbury, Connecticut, which is like the hood of Connecticut. Not fun. The halfway house is just like you would meet guys. It's so bad that guys are like, I don't want, because there's so many rules that they stack up, more rules than in prison. And this is supposed to be halfway to freedom, like reintegrating. There's 9 million rules. So guys would want to say, take me back. I'm not following this shit. Take me back to prison. Just so strict, very petty, very silly. And you have staff that, you know, either just graduated college or they're still in college. They don't care about the job. It's a bullshit pay job. Not even $20 an hour, probably. It's just an intermediate step for them. And there's kids younger than me, and I'm young at that time by the time I got out, but there's people younger than me. These halfway houses are very flawed and they're very for profit. So it's not a good situation.
I have to say, Airbnb has changed my life. I just love staying in Airbnbs. Like in about a month, I'm going to Cocoa Beach, which is right next to Cape Canaveral. I'm going to watch some rocket launches. I'm going to, of course, be staying in a very nice Airbnb on the beach. And it's just such a great experience. Like the whole world is available to us now because of Airbnb. But whenever I'm at an Airbnb, I always realize, you know, the home that I left to come to this Airbnb, I could be making money on that right now by hosting and being an Airbnb myself. So, and I've known people, I had a friend who basically, you know, made a living from turning his home into an Airbnb. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, you do have an Airbnb there. And it can easily fit into your lifestyle, and it's a great way to earn some money. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. The famous Abraham Lincoln quote says, "Good things come to those who wait." I wonder, did he really say that? Jay, did he really say that? Can you look that up? Regardless of who said it, that's only part of the quote. The full quote is, "Good things come to those who wait, but only the things left by those who hustle." Well, if you're a business owner and want the best people on your team, the same applies. And listen, I've interviewed 1,500 people now and a lot of entrepreneurs. I can safely say the one thing consistent among all entrepreneurs and CEOs, the successful ones, is that it's all about the people you surround yourself. If you hire well, you're going to have a great business. And, you know, thankfully, ZipRecruiter puts the hustle in your hiring, so you find qualified candidates fast. This is so important, and I want you to try it. You could try it as a potential employer or employee. You could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter's smart technology finds top talent for your roles right away. Immediately after you post your job, if you're hiring, ZipRecruiter's matching technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I will tell you that I signed up on ZipRecruiter as a potential employee. You know, I just wanted to see how it works. And right away, it started matching me with really amazing potential employers. So give it a try at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Let ZipRecruiter give you the hiring hustle you need. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/James to try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. at what point do you feel like prison changed you? Like, did you start feeling like, oh no, I'm a convicted felon now for the rest of my life. I'm not going to have a career. I'm not going to succeed. Like, did you ever lose hope that life would continue?
No, I was never depressed about it. I think that, you know, I remember seeing and hearing on social media when I went to prison or even found guilty, people are like, wow, he's a felony. His life's over. Like, he's got that on him for the rest of his life. And like, I know my lawyer even played that up at sentencing to try to get me house arrest, saying like, you know, this is extreme. He has a felony. You know, this affects him for the rest of his life. And you know, I got to say, and I'm grateful for this, but it really hasn't affected me like it would to the average person. Maybe that's just my mindset, or maybe that's fate, or whatever it is. I think that what affected me the most was when I got arrested up until after I got out of prison, because that's when the media was slamming me hard. I remember trying to get a job before prison after being convicted, and not even Olive Garden would hire me as a dishwasher because of the bad press. But also I owned the club at that point too, so I was kind of doing my own thing. But when I got out, I was very lucky that I went to Whole Foods and they hired me, and I was able to go from making $15 an hour as a hot bar cook to 3 years later, by the time I quit, I was on track to make $100,000 last year with overtime. I was the manager of prepared foods, $32 an hour, great job. And that was just based my dedication, hard work. I was able, in those 3 years, I got an apartment. I got my own apartment. I got a dog. I got a car. My credit was never affected throughout this whole thing because I never used credit. So I was able to build my credit up, got a car, did all these things, credit cards, things that I never had in my life before. My life was significantly better after prison, because before I was just running a nightclub with no money. And now I fell in love with the idea of working for someone else and having my own money and being able to make $4,000 or $5,000 a month, because I hadn't made that since high school. So it was great. Like, I was loving the grind. I got a second job making pizzas. Never affected me at all.
And did you ever feel like, oh, I need to start a business again or get back into the club business? And
When I first got out, I wanted to get into the club business so bad. I thought that that was my redemption. That was the only way I could ever, like, I figured that was what I was plotting. That's what kept me going in prison. I have all these notes still about what I was writing, just like the plan for the club, what I would name it, all of these things. This was my comeback story. Simultaneously, while like writing a book and selling a book deal and getting a movie made, I studied Wolf of Wall Street. Like, this was my ticket to success. And I slowly realized like I had no money to do that, and I was not going to take investors to do it. So that fizzled out. And it's a good thing it fizzled out, because COVID happened, you know, a year later. So even if I managed to get the nightclub going, it would have been dead. And then I finally caved in and got the job at Whole Foods, because I'm like, you know, I'm pitching my story actively, emailing writers. I get some buzz, like BBC reached out to me, nothing. Like, it was one lead after another, and I'm emailing agents, and it was no after no. I remember I made an Excel spreadsheet, and I had emailed 150 literary agents the first three chapters of the story of my book and a synopsis in the news. Out of 150, six emailed me back. Three of those ended up not being interested. The other three said, after requesting the first chapter, said they're not interested because there's no relevant media or news. The last article written about me was from 4 years prior by Vice, and it was dead. It was a dead story. So I gave it up. I focused on Whole Foods, and I remember the last piece to like getting my whole life together was having a car in my own name. At that point, I was paying for my own insurance. I was totally self-sufficient. And the day I got the car, this was almost a year after I got out, I get an inbox message on Facebook that went to my spam from an intern at HBO, HBO Max. And she pitches the whole thing. Hey, can we get on a call? And something told me to message her back. I messaged her back. She called me. They said, we're doing a docuseries. We want to hear your story. I tell them the whole story on the phone for like 3 hours. Didn't hear anything back for like 6 months. Nothing. I'm like, okay, whatever. At that point, I'm focused on the job. And then 2 weeks before COVID hit, I get an email saying, hey, this is green lit. This is what's happening. You're a part of the series. COVID hits, it gets delayed, but they ended up filming it during COVID and it comes out a year later. And I'm thinking still at that point, this is my big ticket. Like, this is going to blow everything up. This is going to get me to where I need to be at. The episode comes out. HBO Max didn't really promote it that much because it was HBO Max was new at the time. And I was just one episode of 10 other people's stories. And I got landed on like a big podcast, a Mind Pump podcast, which was great. And I got that attention, but my social media didn't blow up. Nothing happened crazily. But the story was out there. And then Vice ends up doing a documentary on me. And that did 3 million views on YouTube. Wow. But nothing major is happening. So I was like, okay, maybe this is not my life. This is not my fate. This is not my journey. I'm just going to stay focused on Whole Foods, work my way up, be a store manager. Life goes on. And then a year after that, a year after Vice, a year after HBO, it was last July, I start getting these thoughts of, is this really what the rest of my life is going to be like? Like, I went from owning a nightclub, doing all these things, making real money in high school. Like, I'm 27 years old at this point. Is there more out there for me? Can I have the opportunity to build something again? Because I don't have a family right now. I don't have kids. Like, yes, I'm in debt, you know, from the past, but is now the time to take a risk? And my friend had been pushing me for months, the videographer from the nightclub days. His name's Mike Squires. And he said, dude, you got to get on TikTok. The way you're able to go viral on TikTok is crazy. It's unlike any other platform. You got to start telling your story. And I was very hesitant, but I start telling my story on Instagram one day a week or once a day, doing these selfie videos behind the HBO Max poster. And I'm just doing a story, mapping it out. And then I start doing it on TikTok. I'm like 4 or 5 videos in. I'm getting like 1,000 views each day. This is last July. And on the sixth video, I get COVID. And I call my friend and I'm like, dude, I can't post a video. I'm in bed. I'm sick. I'm not doing it. Because he said, you have to be consistent if you're going to start this. And he's like, dude, you got to do it. And I'm all snuffly, nose, whatever. And I make the video. And it was about my time being in solitary. The video goes viral. 1.5, 1.6 million views in a matter of days. Blows my TikTok up. Like, I'm getting more followers, this and that. Like, it's getting traction. Not making any money, but it's getting traction. After that video, a producer from MTV reaches out to me. And was like, hey, you know, we love your story. We'd love to cast you on this new dating series we're doing. So I'm like, okay, this is it. Like, I'm a big believer in like fate and everything happens for a reason. Like, this is what my life has came to. This is my opportunity. And there was like a whole interview process and stuff, but I didn't hesitate. I went in the day after I heard from that producer, I put my 2 weeks in at my job.
Wow.
No money lined up, nothing, no deal made. It was because they were already saying, listen, if you get casted in this, you're going to have to be out of the country for 2 months. I had just gotten my passport back from the government too after eight years.
But in a reality series, do they pay you in a reality series?
So, yeah, so I would have been paid for that. Not much, but the exposure I was looking at, you know, to go overseas, they would have had my expenses. I wasn't going to be able to work. And they end up ghosting me. Never hear from them again. And in hindsight, had I taken that opportunity, if I got it, I wouldn't be where I'm at today because I needed to be dedicated to my social media, which is what I did. Kept my head down, focused on social media, lived off my credit cards for a few months, and just started grinding. 3 to 5 clips a day on TikTok, on Facebook, on YouTube, on Instagram, just telling my stories from prison. And it starts blowing up, hundreds of thousands of views. By January, I'm at 100,000 followers on TikTok. YouTube was at 3,000, all these different things. And there's this, I didn't realize there was this huge community of prison TikTokers. And it's 1 billion people watching this in the world. And in about late December, I start thinking, for the first time ever, I'm thinking about the pitfalls and I'm thinking about long term. And I'm like, this is not sustainable forever. I cannot talk about my story forever. And I'm not making any real money at this point, maybe a couple grand a month on social media, nothing major. And so I get the idea to start a podcast. And up until this point, I was very anti-podcast because I felt the market was flooded, you know, and there were already prison podcasts out there. So what would make mine different? come up with this idea for the podcast. I call it Locked In with Ian Bick, kind of the play on prison. And the first two episodes, they were very cringe, like looking back on it, like the first one, two or three episodes, I didn't have a direction. There was no purpose. It was just Ian Bick was interviewing people. And I remember researching these guests and having like 50 questions. And I literally read each, the conversation didn't flow. You know, it was just question after question after question. And we start like pushing the videos out, chopping it into clips. And I make all my own clips, do all the editing for the clip aspect, and no real direction. And then I start thinking, and you know, people start leaving comments, and I'm garnering feedback, and that's when everything like clicks, like in my brain, in the universe, in my mind. This can be an inspirational podcast where you're taking people's stories, their life trauma, about going through the worst of the worst, the American justice system, and telling it in a documentary style way, going through their childhood, something that other podcasts in that genre are not doing, because your average prison YouTube channel starts off with, what did you get arrested for, this and that. We're spending the first half hour learning about someone's childhood. I'm studying, asking the questions that no one else is asking, and it's true crime or whatever meets motivation. And the object, it very quickly came to me, is if the average person that's at home that just went through a divorce, just got broken up with, can't get a job, struggling to lose weight, listens to someone that is borderline dying from an overdose or addiction or goes to prison, loses everything, and is able to turn that around and become successful, that's going to inspire that person that's going through whatever it is they're going through. And when I kept pushing that message and really honed in on it and made it all about that message, that's when things started to go viral. You know, we started getting a couple hundred downloads. And then within 4 months, you know, we're doing 10,000 downloads per audio episode, which is unusual for a brand new podcast. And the thing that really stuck out was the YouTube channel. The YouTube channel, when I posted the full-length podcast for the first time on video, had 3,000 subscribers just off of shorts that I built it. This was January. We're now in August and it has 135,000 subscribers, 100 million plays on the videos. And now our videos are doing 20 to 30,000 overnight. And it's all just pushing that message. And I think the thing that I love about it is that the first 30 minutes of it is just conversation about childhood, about whatever. It's getting to know that person. It's not based on something salacious. Like you see some of these podcasts about sex, this and that, which sells and gets all these downloads, which is great. But that's in the first couple minutes to get the person hooked. We're doing this because we have a very dedicated following. And it's a group, like I talk to agents and stuff all the time. And they're like, you have attracted a group of male, because it's you know, it's 90% male, ages 28 to 34, that don't normally listen to podcasts, but they relate to me in the way I'm telling the story and comparing my story. And I'm one of the few podcasters that have actually been to prison that are interviewing other prison inmates. And they're relating to these stories because these stories have never been told before in this manner. So it's just a very unique experience. And I finally, you know, long story short, I found my purpose and my direction, and that's what's working. And I dropped everything else. I started producing like this commissary cooking show about prison cooking, which, you know, it was getting some views, but I'm like, this is not what I need to be doing. I need to focus on one thing that I'm good at, and I need to make myself better. So every day I'm reading new books. I've been following Jay Shetty, listening to his conversations. How do I get better as a podcaster? How do I get better as an editor? I've moved from cutting all the clips. I make 60 to 80 shorts a week from my episodes, because we're doing 2 episodes a week we're putting out there. So now I'm learning Premiere Pro. I'm doing whatever it takes to bring it to the next level, because this is my life and it's only going to keep going and going and going. And I'm idolizing people like Call Her Daddy, who edits her own clips, and watching her growth and seeing people in the business, because I'm very new to it. I'm only a few months in, but I'm just like this up and comer that's really no one's really heard about and has paid attention to. And I like that it's not built on my past. Like HBO didn't give me this platform. Vice didn't give me the platform. No one gave it to me. I was able to build it through telling my stories on my own and got here.
Mm-hmm. NetCredit is here to say yes, because you're more than a credit score. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partners. NetCredit, credit to the people.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
If people just search on Ian Bick on YouTube, they're going to find your show.
Yep.
That's how I saw you, was seeing your video podcast. It's pretty intense. You've got a great show. And again, you have all these like ex-inmates telling these incredible stories. So it's really like how a police officer is treated in prison. Another one is Kingpin reveals his multi-million dollar crime ring and surviving prison. Another one, mortgage fraud leads to FBI raid in the shower. Like some great stories. Like what's the economics of it now? Are you making a living from the YouTube videos?
Yeah. So, I mean, I have monetized on every platform, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, TikTok, all of these sites pay, and which put me in a unique position as a podcaster, because if say you were to Google, you know, how to make money in podcasting, the Google results are going to say, you know, don't quit your day job and it takes years to monetize. And that's based on the old logic of ads, where, you know, you need X amount of downloads, which are very hard to get, to start getting ads on your podcast. And I've been able to generate, you know, $20,000 or $30,000 a month in revenue without a single ad. We started doing our first ad reads this past month, working with an ad company, because our audio downloads weren't there, but the clips are going viral. And there's so many ways to make money on the short form clips, which now push people to go to the podcast. And I'm getting into public speaking and just doing all these different things. And we just had a call with an agency about doing live shows, bringing my show live, which I think will be great, because it has like the comedy feel to it. It has my personality feel. There's just so many components to it. And I think a big thing too is, you know, there's a lot of prison content creators out there, but I'm unique in the sense where, say you're an adult scrolling through and I'm relatable, because when they stop at me, they're like, there's no way this like white nerdy kid with glasses went to prison. That gets them to stop, and they end up falling in love with the idea that I could have been their son or their grandson or their brother. And I'm super relatable, and they like that. And I get the message out there in a good way, and it's all positive. Like, yeah, you have to have the clickbait, like about the titles and thumbnails, because that's how YouTube works. But at the heart of it, when you look at it, it's not your normal prison show. This is a real like men's mental health type podcast. That's the first of its kind. That's really just, it's getting out there. And, you know, we're going into other fields. We don't just interview inmates. We interview victims of crime, people that have went to prison. I've had family members. We've interviewed police officers, correctional officers. We're going to get into people that have just struggled with addiction, things of that nature.
Wow, it sounds great. And Ian, it sounds like potentially this, you could do this for the rest of your life. This is, you're creating your own little industry here.
I think so. I mean, the direction it's going in, and you know, now it's just about staying really focused and you know, just being careful with like who I associate and getting out there and just like remaining humble. Because you know how it is in today's world, like anything could happen. Like if I say one wrong thing or make one wrong move, like people are watching. So I just have to be very conscious of that and just, you know, stay focused on that. And but I know like in my heart that I need to just focus on this, because for the first time in, I would say 10 years or so, I have something that's working. And I don't want to take that for granted.
And if looking back on your story, like all the past 10 years, is there anything you would say at this point you regret, you would wish you had done very differently?
I wouldn't say regret. I don't live like my life with regret. I would say I always think about like the things that I could have done differently. And I feel bad about like decisions I made. But also at the end of the day, I do realize that I was a kid that was never going to understand those things at the times I made that. I think it would be different if I made those same mistakes now. But I now also have this amazing life experience. And what I find interesting out of this whole thing is that, and I think it's just a message to other people that the thing that was supposed to destroy me, ruin me, which is prison, that dread thing that no one really talks about or wants to talk about, which is why you don't see like celebrities talking about their prison experience when they go to prison, because everyone, it has a negative connotation to it. That's the thing that gave me a career. Like if I got probation, I wouldn't be where I'm at now. There wouldn't be anything. So it's interesting to think in that perspective. Like everything happened exactly the way it was supposed to, exactly for a reason, and it led me to right here.
Do you ever, you're in the same town as where you were conducting all your businesses. Do you ever run into some of the people who lent you money or invested or whatever?
Occasionally. I think a lot of people either moved out or, you know, they don't really say anything to me. I'll run into some people maybe. What I've found is that it's the people that are either owed, you know, not much of anything, like a couple kids from high school that might've been owed like $1,000 or whatever, or the people that aren't owed anything at all that just followed the case that hate on me the most. Not the people that were out the most amount of money.
Like when you say hate on you, what do they do?
I would say like post negative things. People still post negative things on like Facebook. You know,
that's never going to end, I'll just tell you.
It's just interesting to see what people say. I'm not affected by it. I mean, I get hundreds, thousands of comments a day between all my channels, you know, and a lot of it's hate. That doesn't affect me anymore. But people are like, because my videos go viral a lot and the algorithm tends to push it out to like your hometown from what I've seen. So I'm sure it makes people mad and they're like, well, you know, they say the words like he's using his prison experience to, you know, get famous or this and that. But I also know they're not taking the time to go and look at it because it's not about me anymore. Maybe it was about me in the beginning when I first started on TikTok telling my stories, but there hasn't been a recent video of me doing a selfie video talking about my prison experience for months. The message is so much bigger. The brand is so much bigger. It's a real, you know, thing. And I'm focusing on other people's stories. I'm taking stories that no one's ever heard of. And what I found doing this is that it's the people who have never told their stories before that are coming on for the first time that are the videos do the best. The views get the best. I mean, you look at every big podcast in the world, when a celebrity goes on, that celebrity's doing 10 different podcasts that week that all come out at the same time. Who wants to hear the same person tell the same story, you know?
It's true. I will say the least watched or listened to podcast that I do, I'm mostly just audio format. The least listened to podcasts I do are the celebrities.
Yeah.
And because also, by the way, the celebrities aren't that interesting. We already know their full story. And if you're a celebrity because you're like an actor, you might not have much personality of yourself. So there's lots of different kinds of celebrities, but they're not really, you know, the best podcast guests.
I think the other strength I have is that I have a story behind me. Like I have an interesting story that supports me.
Yeah.
Which I think will make my value go up as I get into the realm of, because I haven't done anyone's like huge platform for a podcast. Like I haven't done any of the mainstream podcasts. Yours is probably going to be the best podcast I've done since Mind Pump, you know, in relation to numbers and reach wise. I got a lot of people that reach out to me to do podcasts, like people that are just starting. And I was doing those all at first, but I'm slowing down and stopping on those because it just gets oversaturated and they all say the same thing and they don't direct the conversation in the right way. And that's, you know, no hate on them. They're new and they're starting, but I prefer not to go onto a podcast where they just say, so tell me everything, tell me the whole story. You know, you gotta guide it and direct it. But, you know, I think that it's going to increase my value, my ability to tell stories and have an interesting story. Cause I could be a great podcast host, but not have a story. What's the value in another podcaster bringing me on just to talk about the guests I've had on or whatever? I think that would get old after a while.
No, and I think you having the background you have makes you a better interviewer, of course, on your podcast. So, you know, that sets you apart as well.
Definitely, definitely.
Well, Ian Bick, thank you so much for coming on my podcast, of course. And look, I watch the YouTube version of your podcast and it's great. You're doing a great job. I wish you every luck and success, and thank you for putting up with my tell me everything approach to your story. So I really appreciate it, and thanks so much for coming on the show.
No, thank you, James. I appreciate it, man. You directed it very good. You asked different questions than the average person asked. So that's what I like. And I remember talking to Jay about that too. It was a fun conversation. I appreciate the time, man.
Thanks, Ian.
NetCredit is here to say yes to a personal loan or line of credit when other lenders say no. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partner. NetCredit, credit to the people.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.